I invite you to join me in Genesis chapter 35 as we talk about this crisis that causes Jacob to move from Shechem, where he's been living for about 10 years now, and make his way first toward Bethel, where he will keep a promise he made about 30 years earlier, and then onward to Hebron, where his father and mother are living. Now, the crisis that causes this move is that Dinah's impending marriage to Shechem, the prince of the land, could not be tolerated by two in particular brothers of hers, Simeon and Levi. Evidently, Dinah and Shechem had been involved sexually with one another. They are young people, and they did what so many young people have done, jumped the gun on marriage and got involved sexually ahead of time. So when Shechem and his father come to make arrangements for marriage, to do the right thing, Simeon and Levi stipulate that the only way that they would allow their little sister to get married to Shechem is if every man in the city of Shechem got circumcised, which they do, because they are quite happy with Shechem. They like Shechem. He's their future leader, and they have great respect for him. So Simeon and Levi wait until the third day, when they know it's going to be the most painful part of the post-surgical procedure, and they murder all the males in the city of Shechem, probably several hundred, maybe 1,000 or so. And then they start collecting up all the plunder. And that's when Jacob finds out what's going on. And he gets really upset with his sons and tells them it's because of them that they now have to worry about the local towns around Shechem getting up a small army and attacking him and possibly wiping them all out. And that's the point at which God now decides to intervene. Now, you might want to ask the question, why didn't God intervene earlier, save those people's lives? And it's the same answer that we have to come to for all such questions. Why does God allow bad things to happen? It's because of free will. God cannot constantly go against our free will if we're supposed to have free will. The two are not compatible. So it is my conviction and my teaching that God pretty much allows the free will choices of mankind, even as bad as some of them are, to be carried out unless, for reasons that he knows about, doing so is going to compromise some future aspect of his work. And that's when he tends to intervene. And that's what he does here. In chapter 35, verse 1, God said to Jacob, "Arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there. Make an altar there to the God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau." So God appears to Jacob and says, "Jacob, it's time to move. First place I want you to go to is Bethel, because you still need to finish a promise you made to me 30 years ago when you slept there and saw this stairway going up into heaven and the angels of God going back and forth." So, verse 2, Jacob gets ready to leave. And this is all happening very rapidly. Understand that. This is probably all happening within the day or within a day and a half of the murder of the Shechemites. Verse 2, so Jacob said to his household and all who were with him, put away the foreign gods that are among you, purify yourselves, change your garments. And as I shared with you yesterday, I think that Jacob felt that the presence of idols somehow contributed to this poor choice that was made and the deaths of these Shechemite people. So he wants that stuff gone, and he wants people to start fresh, even with fresh clothes. Verse 3, then let us arise and go up to Bethel, so that I may make there an altar to the God who answers me in the day of my distress and has been with me wherever I have gone. So he communicates to them his decision. I need to go there and finish my promise. What was his promise? That if God takes good care of me on my trip to Mesopotamia and brings me back safely to the promised land, I will build a place of worship at the site where I saw his angels and his tower or his ladder. So he needs to go and finish. Now, verse 4 says that they gave to Jacob all the foreign gods that they had. Now, does this also include the gods that Rachel stole? Rachel stole about 10 years earlier whenever they left Paddan Aram. You remember she'd had them secreted away in her camel saddle? Does it include some things that maybe his sons have started carrying around on their person? Maybe they were kind of mixing with the locals themselves at Shechem and started maybe developing an infatuation with some of the gods and the goddesses of the Canaanites. You know how teenagers are. And maybe some of his newly hired servants have brought with them their gods and their goddesses. But he wants all that gone, and so they hand it all over to him. And the rings that were in their ears, now why the earrings, I don't know. Somehow it must be tied into the gods and the goddesses thing. Maybe they're decorated earrings with images of gods and goddesses. But Jacob hid them under the terebinth tree that was near Shechem. Now when it says he hid them, he basically buried them. The tree that's mentioned in here makes me wonder whether or not this is the tree of Moreh, near which Abraham built his first Canaan altar, and where Jacob probably built his worship altar. So maybe this is his act of repentance on behalf of his camp, that he takes all these objects of worship and buries them under the tree near the sacrificial altar to the true and living God, and says, God, we're leaving all this behind, and we're moving on fresh in our worship to you. So verse 5, as they journeyed, a terror from God fell upon the cities that were around them, so that they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. So God intervenes and protects Jacob's community from being annihilated. This is important to the keeping of his other promises, that in Abraham's seed, all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. If they get wiped out now, that can't come true. So God is intervening here to protect the ultimate messianic mission. And so he puts this sense of dread and fear upon all of the local Canaanites so that they don't even think about trying to chase down Jacob's family. So Jacob came to Luz, that is Bethel, which is in the land of Canaan, he and all the people who were with him. Now he can do that. He can get there in about a day's travel. And so this is the place where he last saw God before going into the Padanaram. And he made promises. He said, if you'll take care of me, I'll build a special worship site here. I'll give a tenth of everything I own to you. And so now he needs to fulfill that pledge. So verse 7, there he built an altar and called the place El Bet-El. And so El, or God, of the house of God, or Bethel, because there God had revealed himself to him when he fled from his brother. So it's been about 30 years since he made the promise, and now that promise is kept. But they don't stay at Bethel, not permanently. They're there for a little time, and then they move on. Verse 8 has a little bit of inserted information that might feel funny, but I think it's related to some other things that are happening. So verse number 8 says, and Deborah, Rebekah's nurse. Remember, Rebekah is Jacob's mom. So Deborah would have been somebody that came from Rebekah's hometown to Canaan and has been living with Rebekah ever since. And so we're talking about a lady that has been around for over 100 years. So Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died. Now, why then is she buried under an oak below Bethel? Apparently, she had come to visit or meet with the family of Jacob at Bethel. Now, why would she come up here? And here's another question. Did Rebekah come with her? Later, we will learn that Rachel is pregnant with Benjamin, and she is in the last bit of her pregnancy. And so it may be that Deborah was either dispatched or came with Rebekah north to be with Rachel during the time of her pregnancy. And now that they are making these quick moves, Deborah dies. Again, she's probably a fairly old lady, so she's had a good full life. But they bury her under this tree there at Bethel, and they call the place Alon Bakut, which is the tree of weeping. Verse number 9. God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Padan Aram and blessed him. This seems to be a recapping of God's appearance to Jacob at this time. And God said to him, your name is Jacob. No longer shall you be called Jacob, but Israel, Yisrael, shall be your name. So he called him Yisrael. So this seems to be a recapping of God talking to him and saying, you remember that I've changed your name. You're no longer heel grabber. You're no longer leg puller. You are the one who strives with God and survives. The guy who strives with God and gets through it. And so this is a reminder to him to act like his name. And then God said to him, I am El Shaddai. Remember, this is your God, the God of your chest, the personal God. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come from you, and kings shall come from your body. So this is a repeat of many of the promises that have been made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as part of the covenant promises. The land that I gave to Abraham and Yitzhak, I will give to you, and I will give the land to your offspring after you. And so a reminder that Canaan will belong to the Israelis the descendants of Israel, Jacob. And keep in mind that the book of Genesis is being read for the very first time by the Israelis under Moses, getting ready to go into the promised land. And so they would have had a special attention drawn to this passage, that the land belonged to them because God promised it to them. Verse 13, and then God went up from him in the place where he had spoken with him. Now, did he go back up the stairway? I don't know. It's possible. It doesn't mention it here, but it does say that he goes back up. And then Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he had spoken with him, a pillar of stone, and he poured out a drink offering on it and poured oil on it. Now that sounds very reminiscent of what he did 30 years earlier after he saw the ladder of God and the angels on it. He took the stone that he'd been using for a pillow, he puts it up as a monument, pours some oil and wine on it, and dedicates that this place will be a place of worship if God does what he says he will do for me. So he now follows through with exactly what he promised 3 decades earlier. And so Jacob called the name of the place where God had spoken with him Beth-El, or House of God. And so it becomes a special site of worship for Jacob and his later descendants will also see Bethel as being a special worship site. And it'll actually cause a little bit of trouble for them because it will be such a special worship site that they will set one of the golden calves of Jeroboam up there act as if that is the physical representation of the true and living God. And it brings a lot of grief into the history of the Israelis. Now let's talk about the rest of the trip. Because remember, they're not just moving from Shechem to Bethel. They're actually on their way to Hebron, where Jacob's mom and dad are. So verse 16, they journeyed from Bethel, and they were still some distance from Ephrath, Rachel went into labor, and she had hard labor. Now, Ephrath is literally fruitfulness, or the place of fruit. It is the more ancient name of Bethlehem, or Bethlehem, the house of bread. And Bethlehem is about 4 or 5 miles south of modern-day Jerusalem. And therefore, what they're doing is they're traveling on this road from Shechem that takes them past Beth-El first. Then it will take them past where Jerusalem will be located, a place that's called at this time Jebus, or Salem possibly. And then from there, it'll take them past Bethlehem. And then from Bethlehem, it's pretty much a straight shot south to Hebron. So when they leave Bethel, the next place that they intend to camp for the night is Bethlehem. So what the story is telling us is on that road to Bethlehem from Bethel, they were still a long ways from finishing that day's trip when Rachel goes into labor with Benjamin. And it is a bad labor. It is hurting her. It will actually kill her. Verse 17, when her labor was at its hardest, the midwife said to her, "Do not fear, for you have another son." So the baby is born, and it's a boy. And so the midwife is trying to help Rachel kind of get her strength back up to live, because she can tell that she's in bad trouble. But it doesn't do any good. Verse 18, as her soul was departing, for she was dying, she called his name Ben Oni. Now, Ben Oni means son of my sorrow. So her final words are, he's the son of my sorrow. And then she dies. But Jacob cannot possibly let that be Rachel's son's name. It's too sad. So he calls him Ben-Yamin, son of the right hand, which means honored son. And this is the number 12 son of Jacob. It is the number 2 son of Rachel. She has Joseph and now Benjamin. And their relative ages are something like Joseph must be around 16, maybe 17 by now. And Benjamin is a newborn. So that gives you the sense of the distance between their ages. There is a bit of irony that comes up later in that many of the recorded famous persons from the tribe of Benjamin are left-handed. So you have a bunch of left-handers coming out of the tribe of the right-handed. Just something to put file away as a bit of trivia for you. Verse number 19. So Rachel died, and she was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. Now, I want you to note here, it does not say that she was buried at Bethlehem. That is a misunderstanding. And unfortunately, it's being reinforced by some bad traditions. Even the establishment of a supposed tomb of Rachel near Bethlehem. But this is what we know next in the story. Verse 20, Jacob set up a pillar over her tomb. It is the pillar of Rachel's tomb, which is there to this day. Now, all you have to do is go a little bit farther in our Bible to 1 Samuel chapter 10, verse 2. And that book clearly locates Rachel's tomb in the territory of Benjamin at Zelzah. Now, of necessity, because of where we know the tribal boundaries are, any place in Benjamin is north of Jerusalem, and therefore at least 4 or 5 miles more away from Bethlehem. So what it is saying here in verse number 19 is that she was basically buried on the road from Bethel to Bethlehem. It doesn't say where on that road, just that that's where she was buried. Now, we can continue looking in 1 Samuel and know that when Saul was being groomed for the kingship, he was told he would meet some people, very specific people, near the tomb of Rachel. And when you read the story, you know that he is a little bit north of his own city of Gibeah. And we know that Gibeah is a couple of miles north of Jerusalem. So that means that Saul must have been more than just a couple of miles north of Jerusalem. He must have even been 2 or 3 miles farther north than that when he had his experience. So Rachel's tomb is even farther north now, deep into Benjamite territory. The final passage that I think helps us really nail down the location of Rachel's tomb is Jeremiah 31:15, which we hear almost every year in the Christmas story. It's the one that says, "A voice is heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping, Rachel is weeping for her children. She refuses to be comforted for her children because they are no more. Matthew actually uses that when he tells his story about Herod killing off the babies in Bethlehem because he's trying to kill off the Messiah. And so a lot of people will use that to associate Rachel again with Bethlehem, but the text actually associates her with Ramah. Ramah is where the Babylonians collected up all the survivors of the siege of Jerusalem and processed them for their deportation to Babylon. And so there would have been a lot of grief and sorrow over the deaths of so many people, many of them little children, in the recent destruction of Jerusalem. And so that's what Jeremiah is trying to communicate, is that Rachel, in her tomb at Ramah, is crying along with the grieving survivors of the destruction of Jerusalem in 587 BC. So I think that pretty much cinches it, that the tomb of Rachel is somewhere near Ramah. That's about 4 or 5 miles, I think, north of Jerusalem. And one of these days, I think archaeologically, somebody will stumble across it and will have confirmation as to exactly where it's at. But anyway, the next thing that happens is verse 21, that Israel journeyed and pitched his tent beyond the Tower of Eder. So the next stop on the road, heading for Hebron, is at the Tower of Eder. So that's probably somewhere north of Hebron a little ways, maybe a little bit south of Bethlehem. And something else happens, another bad thing, which will impact on the inheritance rights of the sons of Jacob.